Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
As new polls reveal Senator Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders overtake Joe Biden in the Democrat primary, America's century-long existential war with socialism takes center stage. We examine where these ideas came from, what they mean, and were they actually tried before, and most importantly, what it means for the 2020 election. This is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show, host of Rational Conservative Libertarian Thinking. Give us those five-star ratings, leave a review, press subscribe, and get a friend to do the same. Buckle up, here we go. Are we ready for football? I know we are. College football is back, but also right now, Major League Baseball is heating up. We have less than 2 months left. In the American League, Yankees, Minnesota, Houston, wildcard Cleveland, I don't know, but also we all know what's really going to happen. The Cubs are going to win the World Series. Let's say that again. The Cubs are going to win the World Series and the Dodgers won't. Mr. Producer gets really upset when I say that, but there's only one place that we trust that has you covered to place your bets. That's betonline.ag, betonline.ag. If you're a sports fan, you want to make a little money on your opinions, you think someone's going to win or someone is going to lose, you think you see something that other people don't see, then go to betonline.ag and use that promo code podcast1 for a 50% welcome bonus. That's the place that we trust, that we know. Of course, we got huge college football action coming up this weekend. Colorado State, Colorado, Utah, BYU, and of course, the big one, the one I wish I could go to, Oregon versus Auburn. We got the Ducks of Oregon versus Auburn, and the Ducks are going to win. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get on the action. Don't forget to use that promo code PODCAST1 to receive a 50% welcome bonus. Again, we got college football. We got NFL preseason, Major League Baseball, all these sorts of options. You want to place a bet, there's only one place to do it, betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts. All right, let's dive right into it. This last weekend, we had the G7 summit. We'll talk a little bit about that. You see all the Democrats going after President Trump on the most baseless issues imaginable. But I pointed out a couple news stories this weekend that I find to be kind of the predicting leading indicators, if you will, of some very troubling trends to come, and also who is going to be the Democrat nominee. That's one of the top questions that I get from people. They say, hey, Charlie, who do you think the Democrat nominee is going to be? Got any inside information? I always kind of laugh. I say, if there's anything I don't have inside information about, it would be about who the Democrat nominee is going to be. It's like, that's all outside information. I can make predictions. I can look at history. I can see how trends are going. But I definitely don't have too many Democrat insider connections. Of course, people, they mean well when they ask. However, as the media has been fixating on many different news stories over the last couple weeks and kind of the horse race of the Democrat Party, we have to all of a sudden reassess the entire Democrat field, because Joe Biden being called the Democrat frontrunner, that's going to change. Joe Biden is dropping like a rock. I mean, there's lots of different nicknames for Joe Biden. President Trump calls him Sleepy Joe. I call him Slow Joe. I don't know if that one works as well, Mr. Producer. Slow Joe. Anyway, Joe Biden is dropping like a rock, and somebody is rising quickly. Somebody is rising like you wouldn't believe, and that somebody is Senator Elizabeth Warren. And we have been predicting that somebody is going to be rising very quickly. And yes, Bernie Sanders is also rising as well. But Bernie Sanders is not drawing the same amount of crowds as Senator Elizabeth Warren. Senator Bernie Sanders is not having the same sort of enthusiasm as Senator Warren has. I mean, Senator Bernie Sanders, in the recent Monmouth poll, did gain some traction. The poll finds a virtual three-way tie amongst Sanders, who had 20%, Warren at 20%, and Biden at 19%. This is a huge change where Biden dropped down from 32%. We have talked time and time again here on the Charlie Kirk Show that you cannot play prevent defense and win the Democrat nomination. You're going to prevent yourself from winning if you do that. If you just think that, oh, I'm going to wait this one out, that I'm going to, and I'm going to beat a nominee inevitably, that is not going to work. So Senator Elizabeth Warren has been drawing massive crowds. In just the last week, she hosted two rallies, one in Minnesota that had an estimated crowd around 12,000 people. Now, that is 1/1024th the size of a President Donald Trump crowd. Okay, that's a cheap Elizabeth Warren joke. Of course, she took the DNA test to try to prove that she was actually Native American when, in fact, she wasn't Native American. Well, she was 1/1024th Native American, which is actually less than the average person's Native American heritage in America. All right, that will be my last Native American joke for the next 10 minutes towards Elizabeth Warren. I shouldn't say my last Native American joke. I'm not making fun of Native Americans. I'm making fun of the fact that Elizabeth Warren pretended to be a Native American. She also drew 15,000 people in Seattle, Washington. Now, mind you, this is kind of playing to the home court, home turf advantage. I mean, she's kind of going to super fans, right? So essentially, it's people that think Seattle is so miserably screwed up that what they need is to vote for more Democrats so they can more miserably screw up Seattle. It's people that think that, yes, homelessness is horrible and our city is in a total wreckage, but yes, the solution will be to elect more Democrats. I'm being facetious, of course, but you look at the cities that are controlled by Democrats, for whatever bizarre reason, these places want more Democrat politicians. And look, going to somebody's home base, this is a very popular strategy in a primary. President Donald Trump did this early on in the GOP primary when he went to Alabama, when he went to South Carolina, when he went to deep red states and drew massive crowds, where he drew significant crowds to kind of show his grassroots appeal. Minnesota's a little bit different. So out of the two kind of rallies, 15,000 in Seattle and 12,000 in Minnesota, the one that kind of really makes me focus and lean in on is the one in Minneapolis. Now, remember, Minnesota is a state that Donald Trump almost won. It was within the margin of error. I mean, Donald Trump barely lost Minnesota, and he won Wisconsin. He had the whole Midwestern sweep, if you will, that was by total surprise and crumbled the blue wall. Democrats took Midwestern hardworking union voters for granted so significantly for so long, and Donald Trump came and talked about failed trade deals, draining the swamp, and recalibrating the political essentially the political landscape, and won convincingly and surprisingly in places in the Midwest, and also won surprisingly in Wisconsin, Michigan, and almost won Minnesota. And Minnesota is a very tricky state. Minnesota has some very deep, some would say socialist roots. I mean, there was the Democrat Party in Minnesota, and then there was the Democrat Farmer Labor Union Party, or called the DFL. And that was a little bit further left-wing, and people such as everyone from Walter Mondale to many others came up, if you will, through the kind of Minnesota ranks of, some would call it socialist, some would just call it progressive. But the fact that Senator Elizabeth Warren is drawing those sorts of crowds, not just in coastal cities, this should be a fire alarm for all Trump supporters out there. This should be not a distress signal, that's the wrong word, but a fire alarm. I mean, if there was a warning sign that the Democrats can carve into the Trump base, if there was a warning sign that Democrats can compete in places that Donald Trump did very well, in places that are quote-unquote Trump country, and you've heard that in the media, this is your warning sign, right here, right now. And actually, we predicted that Joe Biden was going to flounder and that Joe Biden was going to fall and that somebody would replace it. Here on the Charlie Kirk Show, of all places, I have said time and time again, Joe Biden will not be the nominee. I believe firmly Joe Biden will not be the Democrat nominee, because you have to go towards the person who is generating, or the set of ideas, better yet, the set of ideas that is generating the most amount of energy and enthusiasm and focus. And right now, that is Bernie Sanders, or someone in the Bernie Sanders mold. But I'll go a step further. This is not Bernie Sanders' party. This is not Barack Obama's party. It's certainly not Joe Biden's party. And it sure as heck not Robert or Francis O'Rourke's party. I mean, Beto O'Rourke, but I call him Robert Francis O'Rourke because that's his true Irish name, not Beto. This is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's party. Her radical ideas have now become mainstream. They all go out of their way to get anointed and to get endorsed by her. And so we predicted that Joe Biden was going to start to fall. And this is the beginning of the end of Joe Biden. I mean, he was in a campaign stop in New Hampshire. He was in a campaign stop in New Hampshire and he thought he was in Vermont. Now look, everybody misspeaks. Everybody says something and then they correct themselves 5 or 10 seconds later. He said he was in the state of New Hampshire and he thought he was in Vermont.
I've been here a number of times. Last time was, I think, all the way back in 2014, but I've been here before that. I love this place. Look, what's not to like about Vermont in terms of the beauty of it? And what a neat town. I mean, this is sort of a scenic, beautiful town. The mayor's been a good guy, and everybody's been really friendly. I like Keene a lot.
And so, look, Joe Biden is not up to his game at all. Now, look, part of that prediction was about the gravitational pull of the party. The raw energy is in the radical left of the party. The best way that I can describe the base of the Democrat Party is bloodthirsty. They want revenge. They want revenge for an election that Donald Trump was not supposed to win. They want revenge for Supreme Court justices that are not supposed to be in place. They want revenge for an embassy that is not supposed to be in Jerusalem. They want revenge for a trade deal that's supposed to be intact, TPP, NAFTA. They want revenge for a Paris Climate Accord that's still supposed to be intact. They want revenge for an Iran deal that was never supposed to be torn up. They are bloodthirsty. However, part of the saner heads, if you will, the cooler heads of the Democrat Party, have been hedging their bets towards Biden since he announced, saying, yes, we want revenge, yes, we are bloodthirsty, but none of these individuals, to use a nice word, are appealing to us that can defeat Donald Trump, but also accomplish what we want. However, Elizabeth Warren is now threading that needle. What makes Elizabeth Warren's candidacy so interesting is that she's not going after the Bernie voters, which is her natural coalition to build. She's instead trying to carve into Biden's support first. Essentially, she realizes that if she can take some of Biden's support, eventually she will be able to beat Bernie head-to-head, or inevitably merge forces with Senator Bernie Sanders. That Senator Bernie Sanders is philosophically and politically closest to Senator Elizabeth Warren, that she will not have any trouble merging forces or defeating him one-on-one because she's a younger version, she has more energy, she's the newer face to the party, and yes, she is a woman, which is very, very important to the Democrat Party base. But what is so interesting about the rise of Elizabeth Warren and how she is becoming red hot is she's also simultaneously cozying up to the establishment. She knows that, unlike Bernie Sanders, you cannot scream at the sky about how you need Medicare for all and then become the Democrat Party nominee. That it's not just enough to have the most volunteers and the most small dollar donations. That the party apparatus is something that actually matters. And that if you want to have a grassroots movement that will take over the party, especially in a crowded field like this, when you're running against a former vice president that served for 8 years and was in the U.S. Senate for over 30, then it's not just enough to have the most amount of volunteers, most amount of grassroots activists, that you have to woo over enough of the party establishment. You have to woo over enough of the party establishment to be able to get the nomination. And so I see these crowds. I mean, let's say that it wasn't 12,000 people in Minneapolis. Let's say it was half that, 6,000 people in Minneapolis. I mean, that's an extraordinary figure to be drawing those kind of crowds and just for a political rally. Now, mind you, one of the best selling points of those of us that are stalwart supporters of Donald Trump and those of us that are committed supporters of the Trump movement is the crowd size. We point to this time and time again. And this kind of confirms something that I wrote in Newsweek just last week. I wrote in Newsweek that there are far more socialists in this country than we would ever imagine, that there is a hidden socialist vote, and that someone like Senator Elizabeth Warren can draw them out, people that have not voted or passively voted. Now, what does passively voting mean? Meaning, they won't go knock on doors, they won't go make donations, they might go and vote for the Democrat, maybe, they might forget, it's not really exciting. But Senator Elizabeth Warren turns a passive socialist voter into someone that will go knock on 100 doors every single day, 30 days leading up to the election. And you could take my word for it, I see this firsthand on college campuses. I see the Warren signs, and yes, I see the Bernie signs. And when I see Bernie, that's a Warren sign waiting to happen. Warren is a more thoughtful, philosophical, much more strategic Bernie Sanders that will be able to take the populist energy that he was able to start in 2016 and turn it into a movement that will be quite formidable. So I have a lot of thoughts on this, but let's take a step back and talk about the history of socialist movements in this country. And make no mistake, Elizabeth Warren is a socialist populist. And now, if Elizabeth Warren was a little bit more moderate on issues like immigration, student loan forgiveness, and Medicare for all, she would be much more formidable in a general election. I think she is very, very beatable in a general election because she's catering to these wacky identity politics fringe groups in the Democrat Party that, for whatever reason, the conventional wisdom is that you have to cater to the transgender groups and you have to cater to the fringe immigration open borders groups or else you can't win the election. These issues are so out of the mainstream of the consciousness of the political orientation of our country that Elizabeth Warren will find herself apologizing or essentially moderating her positions if she does end up becoming the nominee. And so look, we have about a 100-year history with outward socialist Marxist ideas in America. And one thing that we do here at the Charlie Kirk Show is we try to go a layer deeper. We try to go outside of the canned talking points that you find just on cable television. And we try to say why things are happening, how they happened previously, talk about historical trends that might actually come to fruition now, and we try to go a layer deeper. So now a history of socialism in the United States of America. And first, let's define what socialism actually is. Socialism is rooted in Marxist, Rousseauian ideology that essentially puts the entire paradigm, if you will, of the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat. That there is a group of workers, that there are a group of oppressed people that are inherently being oppressed economically by the evil capitalist. Now, mind you, the word capitalism actually came from Karl Marx. So Karl Marx had a heavy emphasis on the idea that individuals are actually not as flawed upon birth as one would think, and instead, it's the systems that make us selfish, that make us engage in racism, that make us engage in homophobia, all these horrible things. That's actually the capitalist system. It's the profit motive. And if you actually look and you read the Communist Manifesto and you read the Marxist ideas embedded in it, the struggle, as it's put, is the struggle between, as I mentioned, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, but the eventual end game is essentially a form of utopian anarchy. Where there is no state. However, the process of achieving that and the process of implementing those Marxist ideas is by running for political office. But most important, the thing that Marx talked about the most is organizing workers. And so what is essentially embedded in socialist, the one common theme in socialist communist ideology in theory is the idea of workers owning the means of production. Workers owning the means of production. Now, what does this mean? This essentially would mean that if, for example, Charlie Kirk right here, if I wanted to start a business and I wanted to invest $100,000 into a business of my own money and I assume the risk. So in capitalism or in a free enterprise system, which I actually prefer the term free enterprise a lot more than capitalism, I encourage all of you to use free enterprise than capitalism. First of all, free enterprise has much higher approval ratings amongst the American people than capitalism. Secondly, capitalism is a Marxist term, so that's just two really important things. In a free enterprise system, as a business owner, I will assume all the risk. So the people who I employ obviously voluntarily engage with me. They say, I want a job, I want to make a wage, and they, if the business goes under, if the business gets sued, they assume none of the risk. They'll just go find another job. And the business owner, the person who could potentially benefit from all the profit, myself, if this was a business I was starting with $100,000, for example, of all the money I've saved up for my whole life, and I said, this is what I'm going to spend my money on. I'm going to start a laundromat, I'm going to start a restaurant, I'm going to start tire repair shop, or a mechanic shop, or a gas station, whatever it might be. If it's successful, I get to keep the profits. If it's not successful, I will assume the risk. However, what the Marxists believe, and what the communists believe, and the socialists believe, is that it's not fair and it's not right that the flow of capital is actually highly discriminatory and it puts workers at an inherent disadvantage, that the workers should own the means of production. And so this was a real... It kind of makes me sigh because it's a very industrial revolution argument where you had urban cities growing very fast, some would say far too fast, and yes, there was true exploitation of workers, and yes, there was true instances of individuals being taken advantage of. But guess what? That's going to happen no matter what system is created. That's going to happen. That happens today, that happened 20 years ago, that happened 150 years ago. It is inherent in human nature that human beings, unfortunately, certain human beings are going to exploit any sort of power that is given to them. That is not exclusive to just a capitalist system. However, when Marx in particular, when he wrote the Communist Manifesto, he talked about workers owning the means of production. Essentially, he was talking about machinery. He was talking about workers owning the machinery that they were using. Essentially, it was workers should own the stuff that they know best how to operate. And that's what Marx was observing. And Marx was observing that the collective or the commune, which is where we get the word communist, the commune was much more powerful than the singular exploitive individual that or boss or business owner that was exercising dominance over the workers. And this was something that must be, that he said must be challenged, and you must have the labor unions, and you must have strikes, and you must have an uprising. Now, of course, like all things that emanate from the left, this was taken to its way, way, way too far extreme. And so there were multiple communist socialist revolutions and communist socialist experiments. So you had the Russian Revolution, you had the Chinese Cultural Revolution, and the biggest problem with Marxism and socialism, actually I shouldn't say the biggest problem, there's so many problems. Not only does it never work, not only is it flawed, but it's also morally corrupt. It is not morally correct in any sort of respectable moral system to say that I am entitled to somebody else's labor, somebody else's property, and somebody else's stuff. I mean, that is rooted in greed, that is rooted in jealousy, and at the very best, it is rooted in thinking that you can run other people's lives and they can run it themselves. And that is anti-Western, that is anti-Scottish Enlightenment, and you've seen the results. And so in the Russian Revolution and in the Chinese Revolution, but the Russian Revolution in particular, I mean, the universities and the academics, they glamorize the Russian Revolution as if Lenin was some sort of fighter for workers' rights. I mean, it got really bloody really quickly. I mean, when Lenin took power, it took about 2 or 3 weeks before Lenin started to turn on his fellow revolutionaries. I mean, the academy tries to glamorize Lenin as if he was this wonderful individual that was misrepresented by Western media. Oh no, we have not even told the horror of what Vladimir Lenin actually exercised. And so there's so many points I want to make about this because it's so important. There's so much depth. And so anyway, I wanted to define socialism, and so I'm going to kind of stop myself because I could do 45 minutes on just the history of the Russian Revolution, I could do 2 hours on the French Revolution, but this is why you listen to the Charlie Kirk Show, because you're going to hear me talk about all this over a longer period of time as it becomes more relevant and relative. I'm not just going to spend all unnecessary time on just this one topic. So now we know what socialism is, but let's talk about the history of socialism in America. So we have about 100 years history of socialism in America. We've flirted with socialism in many different times. We even had socialists run for president of the United States. What? You probably didn't know that. Eugene Debs, he ran for president 5 times. He ultimately received over 2 million votes running for the United States presidency. Believe it or not, he was thrown into prison by other left-wing president, Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson, I think, is in some ways very, very similar to Elizabeth Warren, but hilariously, Woodrow Wilson, who threw Eugene Debs into prison, I think Elizabeth Warren is the blend of Eugene Debs, Woodrow Wilson, and William Jennings Bryan. I think she's a three-part equation of this period of time. If you asked me what my favorite period of time in American history to study, it's your 1900 to 1930. Right before the Great Depression, America was going through so many different changes. You had World War I, you had the women's suffrage movement, you had Teddy Roosevelt, you had trust busting. I think a lot of those times have actually created some of the negative kind of policy outputs that we see today. And I think the misunderstanding of what happened during that time is actually some of what we have today. I think that we misunderstand it, we misrepresent it, we don't talk about it accurately. And because of that, we have some very, very, I think, some widely held misconceptions in the American political discourse. And so, look, William Jennings Bryan was essentially the father, if you will, of American populism. William Jennings Bryan ran for president 3 times in 1896, 1900, and 1908. He defined the progressive era and ended the Gilded Age, with his popularity completely changing America and the Democrat Party in the process. The party would go on to become the modern progressive Democrat Party over the next 100 years, helped in no small part from Woodrow Wilson, who was an academic, former president of Princeton University, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Kennedy, and Lyndon Baines Johnson. So here's a really important kind of period of time just to zero in on. The 1896 election came during an economic depression, first important point, which led to great distrust among the banks and corporate industry, which were aligned with the Democrat Party under Grover Cleveland. So let me just stop right there. So number one important point, I have two really important observations about the rise of Elizabeth Warren that I think are unusual and something that we haven't seen very often. So typically these great socialist movements happen when times are, people have a lot of anxiety and there's times of great widespread depression. So it's so amazing to me that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are able to draw these crowds and draw the sort of support for socialism in America today when there isn't that kind of economic anxiety and that kind of economic depression. And so we dive deep into the history so that we can compare it to today. So why is it? Well, first of all, if I had to point out a couple reasons, number one, we've lost the universities over the last 30 or 40 years. There has been a strategic and deliberate indoctrination of America's youth to get them to believe something that is patently false, to hate a country that is the greatest wealth-creating engine in the history of the world, that is the greatest engine of prosperity, that is the greatest advancer of human rights. We've lost culture, we lost college campuses, we've lost Hollywood, and we're losing the American family. When you lose those things, and then you have an entire media so determined to destroy an incumbent president, so determined to destroy somebody who is in power, not for rational, logical reasons, but because of revenge, all of a sudden, anything that leader says is incorrect, all of a sudden you believe you have to embrace. So President Trump says America will never be a socialist country. All of a sudden, Elizabeth Warren's followers say, oh yeah, just watch us. We hate you so much, we're going to make America a socialist country. Even though that's not rational, it's not logical, and there's no historical backing for it. However, enough people have gone through these indoctrination institutions. Enough people have gone through the vectors, if you will, of that train people to hate America, that all of a sudden this form of radical socialism becomes more and more palatable. So William Jennings Bryan and Eugene Debs are two kind of different blends of the same topic that I want to kind of label Elizabeth Warren under. Elizabeth Warren is a socialist populist. And William Jennings Bryan, who gained a lot of support, he in the 1896 election, he won 22 states compared to Republican William McKinley, which included the entire manufacturing North and the gold-reliant California, which actually split its electoral votes, interesting enough, 8-1, with one going to Bryan. Look, his brand of populism would define the Democrat Party moving forward. It paved the way for some of the social reforms that defined the Democrat Party and some of the real garbage that the Democrat Party gave us, such as FDR's New Deal and such as Woodrow Wilson's income tax and the reckless destruction of our monetary system that was put forth by Woodrow Wilson, all started under populism that blended with Eugene Debs' socialism in the 19-teens, early into the 1920s. And now if you actually read William Jennings Bryan's writings, and you go through it piece by piece, there's some of it I actually really agree with. And here's what's so important when we talk about populism. I'm very populist in some ways. I believe that populism, in its best and purest form, is being accountable to the American people or being accountable to the citizens. That is what populism is all about. However, populism can go wrong very, very quickly. Populism can deviate in a very dangerous direction if it becomes a competition of stealing other people's stuff and giving it to yourself. Instead of free stuff, we should be arguing for a free state. That is the dichotomy that we diverge from. However, I will say that far too often we as conservatives and libertarians, we say, oh, populism is all bad. It's just people that want a bunch of free stuff. That is not true. That is not true. And Donald Trump realized this. And he realized the economic anxiety of people in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Ohio in particular. He realized that their economic anxiety was not people that wanted more stuff from the federal government. They wanted work. They wanted their jobs back. So they weren't saying to the federal government, hey, give me a check, please. Give me Medicare for all. Open up the borders and, you know, make Green New Deal. They said, hey, is it at all possible that we could open up our steel mill again in our community so I could go to work every single day? And mind you, so think about it. They were pleading for Donald Trump to arguably make them wake up earlier, to arguably make them have less days off. They weren't going to Trump rallies saying, we want checks. We want free stuff. No, no, no. That's what they're saying at Elizabeth Warren rallies. Oh, my goodness. They're saying Medicare for all. They're saying, I mean, at the Andrew Yang rallies, they're saying universal basic income. See, Trump was very, very strategic, and he was philosophically sound to say that, okay, I understand the economic angst. I'm going to create a populist movement
around the defense of Western civilization, around the ideas of hard work, around the ideas of the family, and the ideas of the greatest culture ever to exist in the history of the world, a culture of e pluribus unum, a culture that does not embrace one person or one heritage better than the other, but does embrace that certain ideas are better than others. And so this goes to a second kind of point that I want to make, which is so interesting and so fascinating. So number one about socialist movements that we've seen in other countries and domestically, usually they happen in times of great economic anxiety. Franklin Delano Roosevelt came to power during the Great Depression because people had economic anxiety. Now, I wouldn't go as far to call Franklin Delano Roosevelt a socialist, but he was definitely more left-wing than I would have been comfortable for, or that I'm still comfortable for. Some of the most broken social programs that we have in our country were designed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But number two, what makes this socialist movement and the base of the Democrat Party so unique and something that I have not seen anywhere around the world, even from the Russian Revolution to the French Revolution to the Chinese Revolution, is that this socialist movement is committed to be opposed to the very country that they're trying to take over. See, typically in socialist movements, they're very pro-nation state. They usually valued the very country that they were trying to take over. So they were talking about closing the borders, and they were talking about keeping the interests of the people that they cared about first. And that's you look at Vladimir Lenin, oh my goodness. Vladimir Lenin, when he took over Russia, was talking about how the needs and wants of the agrarian class were being ignored by the growing urban elites. And he said that we must have no immigration and we must put our people first. We've never seen a socialist Marxist movement like this, that they say, we want free stuff, everything we've done is a mistake, our flag is a disaster. This is a new phenomenon where the people trying to take over the country are saying that they hate the country that they're actually trying to take over, and that they're rejecting the cultural icons, that they're rejecting the very traditions of the country that they will soon govern if they are successful. So we've never seen a socialist movement come in a time of prosperity. And it's so stunning to me that so many people that actually want this sort of economic model happening in a time of economic prosperity. And this goes back to my Newsweek piece, and this goes back to my whole kind of premise that there's far more socialists in this country than we realize. Because if Elizabeth Warren can get 15,000 people to show up in Seattle when we had the lowest ever black unemployment, the lowest ever Latino unemployment, the lowest ever Asian American unemployment, the lowest female unemployment in 60 years, and the best economy in American history, how many people will she be able to show up if we ever go into a recession? How many people will the next Elizabeth Warren ever be able to galvanize and ever be able to, how much enthusiasm will she be able or he be able to generate if things get really, really bad? If there's a real economic crisis, if we have a debt crisis, if we have a monetary crisis, if we have real economic anxiety, how many people will they then be able to show up? And that goes to show that if they can get 15,000 people to show up to a rally when the economy is as good as it's ever been, oh my goodness, socialism is a lot more palatable in this country than we ever would have imagined. Let's talk about home security. A recent Gallup survey shows Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft, and even murder. Can you believe it? According to studies, just over 10% of break-ins are planned beforehand. The rest are spur of the moment, crimes of opportunity. In other words, absolutely and totally random. Do you know that most break-ins happen between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m.? In the middle of the day. According to the FBI, the average loss in a burglary is over $2,000. That's right, $2,000. That could be so hard to recover from. And there are over 2 million, that's right, 2 million burglaries reported every single year. That's one every 13 seconds. And what's crazy is that one in five homes have home security. Maybe because most companies really don't make it easy. Most people, I know myself, would not get home security because it's too time-consuming, it's confusing, it's too expensive, it takes too much time. And it's definitely usually a hassle. This is why SimpliSafe is my top choice. Hands down, 100%. SimpliSafe protects your entire home. Every window, room, and door. With 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. They make it easy on you. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print, and it's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. It's easy to order and easy to set up, usually under an hour. It's won ton of awards, from CNET to the New York Times Wire Cutter. Prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So right now, visit simplysafe.com/Charlie. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure you've got to go. You've got to go to simplysafe.com/Charlie so they know our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/Charlie. Do it right now. All the properties I care about have SimpliSafe. That's simplysafe.com/Charlie. And so Elizabeth Warren understands the power of populism. And so she's not just going to be an outright socialist where she's just going to talk all about Medicare for all, open borders, but she also is going to target what I believe is the number one issue facing America. And it's not the economy. It's not ISIS, it's not North Korea, and it's not even China. I mean, China is America's greatest enemy. But why is it that we can't take China on? Why is it that we can't build the wall? Why is it we can't balance the budget? All of it comes down to structural reform. I've talked about this so many times at so many different places. We talk about it on the Charlie Kirk Show. We talk about it on college campuses that Washington, D.C. is bought and paid for by the rich, the few, and the well-connected. That as Washington, D.C. gets more wealthy and the budget gets bigger, America gets further disenfranchised. You want to know why we had bad trade deals? Because people had good lobbyists. You know why we have open borders? Because people had good lobbyists. You know why we declare reckless, endless wars overseas? Because people had good lobbyists, well-connected, and the system is broken. This is something I fundamentally agree with Elizabeth Warren on, and guess what? President Trump agrees on it as well. This is populism at its best, but it's also a danger sign. I've said this for over a year now. I've said if any Democrat channels the populist energy of the phrase drain the swamp, President Trump is going to have more difficulty running against that person than slow Joe Biden. Mr. Producer doesn't like that, so I'll say sleepy Joe Biden or Joe China that my friend Steve Hilton on Fox News always talks about. Steve Hilton, total American patriot. Steve Hilton has more patriotism for America despite him being born in the United Kingdom. Go figure that one out. That's a really interesting one. Despite all of this, Elizabeth Warren understands the greatest issue facing America, the reason that we cannot get simple things done, the reason we can't cut spending, the reason that we can't balance the budget, the reason we can't cut taxes for middle-income earners, the reason we can't end these foreign wars, the reason we can't build the wall, the reason we can't have a sane immigration policy is because Washington, D.C. is broken. The reason we cannot have school choice is that Washington, D.C. and the structural institutions within it are corroded. So I went to her website today and I said, what is Elizabeth Warren? She talks a good game about it. What does she actually say on her website? And I'll tell you, I'm going to be very honest with you guys. I find very little I can disagree with this page. Now, mind you, she talks about Medicare for all, total nonsense. She talks about immigration, even more nonsense. She talks about climate change, beyond not. Like, she just loses me in the first two words, right? She, like, two words into her immigration policies, pablum, dogma, whatever. It's just total balderdash. It's nonsense. But on this page, ending... Here, I'm going to read straight from her website. How about that? I'm going to tell you guys exactly what it is on her website. Now, mind you, we're going to have the next 14 months, if she is the nominee, which I believe she will be the nominee, we're going to have the next 14 months to talk about her fake Native American heritage and her hypocrisy as a professor. Again, you're going to hear a lot about that, and you'll hear it from me. But I want to zero in on this because I think those of you listening to this show, you want something deeper, you want something new, you want something fresh. And I want you to understand here, do you disagree with anything I'm about to say? I'm about to quote from Senator Elizabeth Warren, and guess what? I agree with more than 1/1024th of what she says here. Okay, that was my second fake Native American joke for the episode. Here we go. End quote. End Washington corruption. Washington works great for the wealthy and the well-connected, but it isn't working for anyone else. Companies and wealthy individuals spend billions every year to influence Congress and federal agencies to put their interests ahead of the public interest. This is deliberate, and we need to call it what it is, corruption, plain and simple. That's why Elizabeth, oh my gosh, has proposed the most ambitious set of anti-corruption reforms since Watergate to fundamentally change the way Washington does business. We will start by ending lobbying as we know it, by closing loopholes so everyone who lobbies must register, shining sunlight on their activities, banning foreign governments from hiring Washington lobbyists, and shutting down the ability of lobbyists to move freely in and out of government jobs. We will also shut the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington and permanently ban senators and congressmen from trading stocks in office and from becoming lobbyists when they retire, not for 1 or 2 years, but for life. We will make the justices of the Supreme Court follow a code of ethics and strengthen the code code of conduct for all judges to make sure everyone gets a fair shake in our courts. And we will force every candidate for federal office to put their tax returns online. Okay, that's just nonsense, but whatever. That's the only thing I disagree with. Together, these sweeping structural changes will end the dominance of money in Washington, taking power away from the rich and the powerful and putting themselves where it belongs with the American people themselves. End quote. Okay, so let me just tell you what I disagree with. The putting tax returns online, I think that's a bunch of nonsense and garbage for a lot of different reasons. It will sway really successful people from actually running for office, and you want successful business people not to have to disclose their actual own personal business dealings, because actually you don't want people to serve in government forever. You want them to go back into the private industry. You want what the founding fathers envisioned, where you leave your farm for 18 months and you go back to your farm after you're done with it. And nowhere in this diatribe is there anywhere about term limits. Look, it's a total political swipe at the President of the United States, and I disagree with that completely. The other thing that I disagree with on here, well, I don't actually disagree with it. I just think that she's trying to go after Brett Kavanaugh with the Supreme Court to follow a code of ethics and strengthen the code of conduct. Actually, if you look at Supreme Court Justice Kagan, she had a huge conflict of interest when it came to the Obamacare dealing. Mr. Producer, dig that up right here. There was a huge conflict of interest under the Obamacare dealing, and she should have recused herself, and she didn't, and that wasn't covered by the media at all. So those are just two things that came to mind. Besides that, though, I fundamentally agree. Banning foreign governments from hiring Washington lobbyists? Of course. This is why foreign governments have embassies. Why do foreign governments need to hire Washington lobbyists? I mean, they have ambassadors. They have State Department relations. Why do they need to be able to hire Washington, D.C. lobbyists so that they then can essentially do pseudo-campaign finance money laundering to contribute to people to contribute to people running for office? I mean, this is total and complete corruption. I agree with her. And by the way, the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington, I totally agree with that. Permanently banning senators and congressmen from trading stocks in office, common sense. And becoming lobbyists when they retire, more common sense. Look, this is something that both parties have not talked about for far too long. And Senator Elizabeth Warren, boy, you have more than one 1,024th support of me when I talk about this. And my point is this, is the reason why she's drawing the crowds is that she's intersecting socialism with common sense mainstream populism. And I've said this, and the person that gets this right, the person that gets the corruption in government right is going to be rewarded politically for the next 20, 30 years. The number one issue in America facing the American people is they believe that their voice and their own life is not being accurately represented in Washington, D.C. This is why Donald Trump won. He said the phrase, drain the swamp. Well, this is, guess what Elizabeth Warren is saying? End Washington corruption. That's a more political correct way of saying drain the swamp. And Mr. Producer acts quickly as always. Quote, when in 2010 Obamacare passed and Ms. Kagan was Solicitor General, Ms. Kagan viewed the passage as simply amazing and that she assigned a deputy in her office to help prepare legal defenses to any challenges to Obamacare. She was obviously conflicted there. When in another email she was asked for her opinion on a meeting to discuss legal defenses to Obamacare, Ms. Kagan replied, what is your phone number? Indicating either she had a too long-winded response or that she foresaw a possibility that her emails might force her to recuse herself if she saw that in the rule of law or both. At any rate, she had in fact participated as a counselor or advisor of the law when she was Solicitor General. She clearly is not impartial about the fate of Obamacare, so she should have recused herself in that case. Tom Thurlow from The American Thinker. So to kind of go to Elizabeth Warren, who was trying to make some sort of swipe at Neil Gorsuch or Brett Kavanaugh, it's interesting enough, under her own recommendations, of which I agree with, maybe Obamacare would not be the law of the land. And so look, kind of to tie this whole point together, here I'm reading someone who says, Elizabeth Warren calls herself a capitalist. She's not a capitalist. But she's smart, folks. Here's the difference between Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren. Senator Bernie Sanders will say he's a socialist. Senator Elizabeth Warren will not. Which of those two is following the rules of radicals by Saul Alinsky? Who is Saul Alinsky? I'm glad you asked. Saul Alinsky was one of the most effective community organizers who wrote the playbook of the American left, Rules for Radicals. In Rules for Radicals, he dedicates Rules of Radicals to Lucifer, the first fallen angel. That's right. Actually, in Rules for Radicals, he dedicated the book to Lucifer. And within Rules of Radicals, he says clearly that people should not say who they really are. He says that a true radical is someone who slicks their hair back, goes to work every single day in a three-piece suit, and doesn't protest in the streets, but instead infiltrates institutions and doesn't actually say who they really are. That's who he says a true radical is. So is a true radical Senator Bernie Sanders who says that he's a Marxist or a Democrat socialist? Or is a true radical Senator Elizabeth Warren who says she's a capitalist and talks about ending Washington corruption? And look, I will give Senator Elizabeth Warren credit. I mean, she talks a good game on ending Washington corruption. She hasn't taken PAC money. There's been one thing about where she used a Democrat donor to acquire a list, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of hypocrisy, and she will take money from all these people eventually when she's the nominee. But to date, she has not held a single high-dollar fundraiser, and she's only taken small-dollar contributions and donations. And so putting all these pieces together, we see Joe Biden slipping miserably, and it will be the end eventually of Joe Biden, but you're seeing the beginning of the end, and we predicted this on the Charlie Kirk Show, that the end of his campaign was when he launched his campaign. I mean, he doesn't even know what state he's in. He can't talk about his text alerts correctly. He says President Cory Booker. And you know what? People say, oh, I feel so bad for Joe Biden. I don't feel bad for a guy that sold out our country to China, our greatest enemy. I don't feel bad for a guy that time and time again has shown to be very corrupt, who called Ukrainian officials to try to get his son out of potential criminal probe. I don't feel bad for people like that. I just don't. And look, this is just the beginning of the end of Joe Biden. The Democrat Party wants someone that is bloodthirsty. That's Elizabeth Warren. They want someone who's in the intersectional kind of category. That's Elizabeth Warren. They want someone who is able to beat Donald Trump. I don't think anyone is able to beat Donald Trump. However, they think Elizabeth Warren is able to beat Donald Trump. And that's why I think everyone should watch very closely about the rise of Elizabeth Warren, but understand the history, that she's not the first socialist and not the first populist to run, that we had William Jennings Bryan and that we had Eugene Debs. 125 years, socialists have been sowing the seeds of socialism for over a century. So here's kind of the main kind of climax thesis point of this entire episode, is that this did not happen overnight. As my friend Michael Knowles talked about on his podcast, and I encourage you to go check out my pretty long-form interview with him, he cited Ernest Hemingway, where he said, Ernest Hemingway said, it happened gradually, then suddenly. That's exactly what is happening with the socialist movement in America. Socialists have been sowing these seeds for quite some time, infiltrating our institutions, corrupting our culture, and breaking down the American family. Three-part process. Take over the schools, take over Hollywood and the media, break down the family. All of a sudden, socialism sounds really good when you have a broken family, when you've been taught it's the greatest thing ever and capitalism is horrible, and you see it on TV nonstop. That Elizabeth Warren and her success and her big crowds in a time of prosperity, I mean, if the stock market crashes, and for whatever reason, if we have a monetary crisis or debt crisis that is outside the controls of Donald Trump, that crowd in Seattle won't be 15,000, it'll be 100,000 people. Because when people have real economic anxiety, all of a sudden it becomes a lot easier to say tax the rich and storm the Bastille, or, you know, 1, 2, 3, F the bourgeoisie, as they like to say. I mean, the left's rallying cries all of a sudden become a lot more resonant when things are not good. But the fact that they're resonant at all in times of prosperity should be a warning sign to every single person listening to this podcast. And this is why that we at Turning Point USA are so focused on the fight against socialism on college campuses. TPUSA.com, that's TPUSA.com. If you want to get engaged or involved against the rise of socialism, I encourage you to go. You can sign up, you can start a chapter, you can contribute, you can donate online. It's TPUSA.com. Highly encourage you to do that, because I tell you right now that the rise of socialism in this country has happened within our institutions. Yes, I believe that we can beat socialism at the ballot box. Yes, I believe we have to beat socialism at the ballot box. But just thinking that a political referendum against socialism is going to make it go away, you are widely mistaken. Eugene Debs got 901,000 votes in 1912 and 919,000 votes in 1920. And guess what? His ideas have only grown since then. It's not as if we dismiss socialism, we put it into the ashbin of history. Yeah, you might have thought we did that with the Berlin Wall. You might have thought we did that, you know, against all the different failed socialist experiments. And one of the things I'm going to talk about in the next episode of the Charlie Kirk Show that I don't think gets talked about enough is that we have extremes and we have guardrails for when far right-wing ideology goes too far, when evil people have evil ideas where they say one race is better than another, another which should be repudiated completely and categorically. But we don't really have societal or cultural guardrails when left-wing ideology goes too far, such as everyone's outcome should be exactly the same, or that one oppressed victim group really is entitled to other people's stuff or other people's earnings because of something that happened to someone they were related to 150 years ago. We don't have unequivocal guardrails when Marxism goes too far. We certainly, as a country and a society and a culture, have that when right-wing ideology goes too far. Or I should say team right-wing ideology. And I will talk about what team right and team left and the problems with our terms. And I'm actually going to dive into that on the Charlie Kirk Show, of where the terms and the kind of the team's idea, if you will, where we get the term right-wing and left-wing and where that divergence has actually happened. The whole language is totally and completely corrupted. That's another episode for another time. But we know when fascism goes too far. We don't always know when Marxism goes too far. In fact, we really don't. We just allow it to go endlessly into the oblivion. And it kind of turns the back on any of the failed experiments, whether it be Castro's Cuba or Stalin's Russia or Pol Pot's Cambodia or Mao's China. We have seen tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people die under those ideologies. And yet we seem to not have any sort of societal understanding or acceptance when that happens or how to reject it or repudiate it. But that we will touch on the next episode of the Charlie Kirk Show. And so watch very keenly and very intently and understand that socialism happens gradually, then suddenly. They have infiltrated our core institutions, and someone like Elizabeth Warren, that both intersects the righteous indignation that people have towards Washington, D.C., and the corruption with D.C., blends that with highly horrific ideas of socialism and Marxism, could be much more successful than people think. Stay keenly aware of that, and we have to start defining the terms of the 2020 election today. Because if she's drawing 12,000 people, if she's drawing 6,000 people in Minnesota and is raising the money that she's raising, we got a serious, serious issue on our hands. You can never underestimate the opposition. You underestimate the opposition, you are going to lose. That is what Hillary Clinton did to Donald Trump. That's what John McCain did to Barack Obama. And you get the point from there. Thanks so much for listening to your home of conservative, libertarian, rational thinking. Please give us those 5-star ratings. Leave a review. You leaving a review helps more than you could possibly imagine. It helps us surge in the charts. If you are not subscribed, please do so. Get your friend to do the same. Signing off, this is Charlie Kirk from The Charlie Kirk Show. Thank you so much.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.